In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
Four South Dakota communities suffered the loss of their local newspapers. From STPB, today is Wednesday, August 13th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, journalist Kevin Wooster joins us. We'll talk about newspaper closures in Brookings, Huron, Redfield, and Flandreau. We'll explore the landscape of local journalism in South Dakota with a look at nonprofit newsrooms, new startups, and volunteer-run papers. Later in the hour, journalist Megan Raposa joins us for a look at a local journalism initiative that seeks to help Sioux Falls residents understand the complexities of their city government. That's all ahead of a big mayoral election next year. But first, we remember a South Dakota philanthropist whose contributions to the state were sometimes anonymous, sometimes monumental. That's coming up after the news. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Paul Christian passed away on July 27th. He was a business owner, a baker, a banker, a bottler. Here at home, he was most well known as a philanthropist and a member of the South Dakota Hall of Fame. Born in Minneapolis, he grew up in Mitchell, was a longtime resident of Huron. He left a mark across industries and communities in the state, and that included running 18 First Western banks and serving as the director of the South Dakota Science and Technology Authority and Research Facility in Leete. He founded the South Dakota Community Foundation, and he set up local foundations in Sturgis, Wall, Custer, Hot Springs, and Belfouche. He and his wife also raised $60 million to help preserve Mount Rushmore and donated $1 million to the Crazy Horse Memorial. I talked with Rebecca Polid, Paul Christian's daughter. First of all, what I want to express my condolences, but yet also at 96 years old with a life this well-lived, it's also a celebration. And so I've just enjoyed reading about your father. So thank you for coming in and being willing to tell a little bit of his story as well.
Well, you set it up right for me to tell you that when I called our oldest son, who is 44, I think, and said, "Tom, your grandpa died today." And he said, "Well, Mom, he lived a very long life." Maybe he said a very full life and then some. And so I think that's really a true expression. I know it's hugely sad. I think it's a loss for South Dakota that he is gone because he loved his state so much. But he certainly, it's hard to overly mourn when somebody had such a nice long life.
Yeah. And yet the legacy of someone like this, it seems like sometimes it's hard to imagine that it can be repeated. So you're mourning a person and the things that he won't see in your personal life, but then also realizing how rare it is to have someone with this kind of fingerprint on an entire state, not just a family.
That's exactly right. And I think the state will feel it for much of their life. And I believe it was a quote in his obituary that he wanted to do things for people he would never know. And he meant that. He really wanted this to be a long, you know, he had long fingers out into the state of South Dakota, especially.
Tell me a little bit about some of your early memories of him as a dad. Before you realized everything that he had in the community and everything he was doing in business, how did you see him at first?
Well, of course, I'm 70 years old. When people ask me that question, I can hardly remember back that far. But I remember having a very happy life, a very warm family life. We went to church on Sundays. We had family lunches. I was close to all four of my grandparents from Mitchell, South Dakota. They were up all the time, or we went to Mitchell. It was just a sort of, without sounding too corny, a little bit of a Norman Rockwell life for my sister and I.
Yeah, he showed up for you as a father. And sometimes that was not easy to accomplish because he had to fly in from one of his business ventures to show up for you. Tell me about that.
That's true. And he always made a point to be there for the important things. And we understood that what he was doing was good, but he did always just show up and he was there every weekend. So weekends were some sort of non-negotiable. He was always home and out doing things with my mom and friends and having family time, especially as I say on Sundays.
Yeah. What did you know that he did for a living? And how do you explain that to people? Because he has his hands in, business, banking, philanthropy, Boy Scouts.
A business person, and I oftentimes, as a young girl, tagged along with him and would go and just, I was a content person. I could just sit in a meeting while he was having a meeting and, just sit there and listen to people talk. I wasn't particularly interested in business, nor did that was not something I majored in, but I just was happy to be with my dad. So I would tag along quite frequently.
What are some of the things that, as you look now at his life, particularly in South Dakota, that you think people should know that he was a leader in?
I feel like the stories that I know that are true, that if any, usually a governor or somebody in some power came and asked him to do something, the answer was yes. Will you raise money to fix Mount Rushmore? Yes. Will you help raise money that we can make Crazy Horse a dream to have this, our next big monument in South Dakota? Yes. There was never a really no, I won't do that. And he was especially believed in small towns, being from Mitchell and Huron. And so the idea of starting the community foundations, which then feed money into all these other little communities for their betterment, was just something he super believed in.
Yeah. Did he ever tell you why it was important to do things like connect with people who would never know that you were part of helping them or to make sure that rural philanthropy could thrive? Did he express a philosophy to you?
I don't think he ever told us directly, but when I have been asked before, I said that was just the way we were raised. We just were to give back, going with the saying, to whom much is given, much is expected. And that was sort of a belief. Now that I think back and people ask me certain things, I think I wish I'd asked more. I knew my grandparents really well. They all died after I was married in 78. So I grew up having my grandparents in my life, but I don't remember them. I remember through their church, they were always generous and this and that. I'm not sure that dad's came right exactly through that or just his wanting to help. I mean, being a Boy Scout was important, liking people, taking care of people. Those were all just things that I think stuck
Yeah.
with him.
In fact, according to, the obituary, being a Boy Scout might have saved his life.
That is 100% a true story, and I will be talking about it in my eulogy, that when he lost his leg, he remembered his Eagle Scout training and took his tie off and tied a tourniquet on his leg so not to bleed to death.
Wow.
And
That was a plane crash.
a plane crash just off the runway in Huron, South Dakota. Going back to Minnesota, having come home for the night for something, and I can't remember. I mean, I was in maybe 7th grade, so I can't remember. Did he come home because there was a band concert or something? But it was nothing that I ever felt like guilty or thought about that way.
Yeah, and he lost his leg?
He did lose his leg,
Yeah.
and but that didn't stop him. He just went on, and the kind of person he is, and I don't think I got this quite in my eulogy, but one of our other sons said to me, "Well, are you going to bury Grandpa's leg with him or what?" And then so then that became a big discussion with his very close caregivers that have been with him for years, and my sister and I. And one of the caregivers said, "But whenever he got a new leg, he donated his old leg to somebody that couldn't afford to get a leg." Now that's a really true story of my dad, not just, okay, get rid of that leg, I'm getting a new one. somebody else is getting the benefit of that.
Wow. Yeah. But where did you learn about work ethic from him? What did you learn about work ethic from him? What was the nature of how he worked?
Well, he wrote everything down. He had a legal pad. He always had a legal pad, and he would write. You know, he didn't have the best handwriting, but anyway, he'd write everything down, and he liked to check it off. It was get it done and check it off the list. And I think that's kind of the way my calendar looks today, too. I still prefer a paper one where I can look at it at the end of the day and say, I checked that off my list. And so I can see to the end that legal pad sitting next to him when he'd be reading or reading the newspaper. He probably made a note like, oh, I should call somebody or do this or do that. So he was very methodical in how he did things.
Yeah. Did he save those? I mean, does he have are there years and years of legal pads, or did he get rid of them once the list was checked out?
I would guess he threw them away. I mean, I have not been through his desk, nor really needed to for any reason, because he made very clear how in the last 2 years, when he and I would see each other frequently, this is what I want at my funeral. This is the song. This is the this. This is who I want to speak. You know, he was going to be sure. He didn't have to write it down because I couldn't remember that. But he did have a very clear vision of how things were going to be, and that he had done what he wanted to do for the state and to take care of his, you know, wrapping things up with his life. And he was just a content, happy person toward the end.
Yeah. What was it like for you as his daughter if you went in a different direction than what maybe he saw for you?
I don't think I ever disappointed him. He seemed to, I don't recall him being too mad at me ever or anything. And he was proud of both my sister and I, very much so. And my sister, for the last 10 years, did do business with him. She sort of runs our family business. So she's the one that kind of, you know, did that with him. Yeah. And I could just be, you know, the daughter that had dinner parties and had everybody over for Christmas and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I was up at Dakota Wesleyan University not too long ago this summer and saw the St. John's Bible with your mother's personal Bible in a display for all visitors to come and look at. What an extraordinary gift for people who haven't been to Dakota Wesleyan. Tell us a little bit about your mom and her devotion and how you as a family decided to help remember her.
Well, my parents both went to Dakota Wesleyan University, and they were very proud of that and lifelong supporters on both of their sides. I mean, Dad has been on the board for years and years and years, and still is, you know, sits on some committees. So even to the end, he was on their calls or would go down when he was in Huron to Dakota Wesleyan. And he was immensely proud of donating that Bible. My sister was there with him that day and feels very strongly to this day about Dakota Wesleyan and what it gave to him and his life.
Anything else you want to say to South Dakotans today about his legacy here?
I think it will be a long-lasting legacy. I think there will be people years from now that say, I don't think I knew who this person was, but I've heard about him, and he's somebody I want to research, or I want to look at and see what they really did, or what, you know, I oftentimes will watch a program on TV. So I hope people find that to happen to them, that they see something that has my dad's name on it, although he wasn't big on having naming rights to things. But, you know, you might see something at Crazy Horse and say, who are those people, Paul and Donna Kristen? I want to find out about them. And I hope that's what happens.
That's Rebecca Pollard remembering her father, Paul Christian. He was an entrepreneur and philanthropist. He passed away a few weeks ago. Services are tomorrow, August 14th, at the Faith Alive Community Church in Huron at 10:30 a.m. local time. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Last week, four South Dakota towns became local news deserts. The News Media Corporation closed without warning the Brookings Register, Huron Plainsman, Moody County Enterprise, and Redfield Press. So for this week's Dakota Political Junkies conversation, we called in the expert, Kevin Wooster, longtime journalist in the state of South Dakota. He joined me from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Let's start with like how it was done, how quickly it was done with very little notice for the employees or the communities.
My understanding is that they just, that some of them, that it was on social media before they got the official notice from this news media corporation based in Illinois, and that they were shutting them down. And so suddenly the Brookings Register and the Huron Plainsman, Redfield Press, and the Moody County Enterprise, they were done. And there was no advanced warning, as I, you know, to me it was just horrible that you can't give human beings a couple of weeks, a month, say we're probably going to be shutting this thing down, so you better start making other plans. Not certain that they're going to get all the money that they're due, even their pay, that the corporation said we hope to, we'll try, but... So suddenly a bunch of journalists, a bunch of people that worked at these papers were out of a job, bang, in a day.
Yeah. Subscribers don't get refunds for their subscriptions, but employees are going to be out of health insurance and their paychecks for a time they've already worked.
Yeah, all of a sudden.
Yeah, possibly.
And, you know, so suddenly they're having not just to think about other jobs, but to think about health care coverage and...
Right.
You know, whether they've got financial savings, you know, things set that they can go for a while or not.
And let's be honest, if you're working at a local newspaper, you know, you can be very thrifty and thoughtful with your money, but you're probably not pulling an executive level salary either. So these are probably not super high paying jobs.
No. And I mean, I always tried to have a few months in reserve. People always tell you that, but that's hard to get, especially when you're younger and or if you started a family and you've got a new mortgage and got a car payment and things. Having said that, you and I maybe a little bit about, you ask yourself, how in the world can a paper in Brookings, home to the largest university in the state, all the things going on there, which seems like a thriving downtown area and a business community, how can they not support a newspaper?
Mm-hmm.
And now there's some indication. Last night I saw on social media, Josh Linneman, the managing editor, said that he has been contacted by a number of people about maybe a way to hold on to a paper there.
Right.
He's not ready to talk about it, maybe you see that, but that he's going to be making some kind of an announcement pretty soon, he hopes.
Yeah.
And we all hope. It would be great if that paper could come back or something like it could come start up.
Yeah, so a couple things are happening here. One, it happened without notice. Again, to your point, there wasn't a lot of time to build the kind of community support that might be required. It's an out-of-state company that specializes in rural newspapers. Out-of-state is tough. If you don't have, you go to the grocery store, you're going to see the editor of the paper and some of the reporters, but you're not going to necessarily see the publisher. And that makes it a whole lot easier for a publisher to make a decision about what happens in a community.
Oh, man, it does. And what you said there makes me think about a paper that is making it. And there are a few of them, and I think, you know, we should talk about it. Mitchell Daily Republic seems to be doing okay at this point. And the Black Hills Pioneer, I had a social media message back and forth with Letty Lister over there, who I think is just a really exceptional publisher. And they maintain... 6 FTE reporters there, which I think maybe more than the Rapid City Journal has anymore. We had 16 at one time when I was there. And she called it a fierce commitment to local news. She's the publisher, and to your point, you do see her in the grocery store. You do see her in places. And when you come to their office, and I've been there, you're greeted by a human being at the front who knows the area, who's willing to handle your problems. The ad staff, same way. They're out in the community all the time. They're part of the community. They have full-time graphic designers still there, which to me is almost unheard of in a newspaper anymore, that you'd have that. They do little things that are important things. They have columnists, they have correspondents, they maintain that. My wife for the last 2 years, Mary's a retired journalist, and she has done play reviews for them for the Black Hills Playhouse. Remember, play reviews used to be just a normal part of most newspapers if there was a theater group around.
Yeah.
And
boy, in Sioux Falls, Anne Gravigold walk in the theater and people get nervous.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she was going to tell the world how the show was the next day, and she was going to mean it.
Yeah, she would. And sometimes there'd be a hard stone in her writing about a certain thing.
We had critics at one point. And you know, just a quick sidebar, a good arts critic in a community makes art better.
It does. She does.
A good reporter will, will elevate the level of, college or high school athletics. And, so it's not just the daily news. Yeah. It's also some of those things that are happening in a newspaper.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to be part of your community. And it's a challenge. As Letty was saying, it's a challenge. And when you have added things like on and off tariffs and affecting newsprint and things like that, it adds more to this very thin margin that they have and they maintain. But if you read that paper, and I think you could say much the same about the Mitchell Republic. I always want to say Daily Republic, which it used to be. It's not really daily anymore. It's in terms of print, it's daily online, obviously. But I think they're connection with Forum Communications and their connection with Sioux Falls Live, and I think you can buy one or the other and you get both and you get access to Forum. But also have a guy named Luke Hagan there who's a big fisherman. He's a guide on the Missouri River, and he understands the area and is committed to the area and loves the area. And again, you see those people in the community, and that wonderful old brick building, the Mitchell Republic building, is no longer the Mitchell Republic, which is sad. They've moved, as the Argus and the Journal have done, to other quarters and a lot of home work, I think.
And something is lost there, too. I mean, something is lost.
Gosh.
I mean, if you're not in a newsroom, what was it like being in a newsroom? I always freelanced when I did print, so I was rarely in the newsroom, so I was kind of doing a remote work before it was cool. But being in the newsroom makes a big difference to the kind of work that you do. How so?
Oh, man. And no other place like it in my experience. I've been in a lot of work environments as a reporter, but the kinds of personalities you find there, the kind of cynical, but suspicious, but also outgoing, and all different kinds. And then the community is in and out of a newsroom all the time. I mean, the elected officials stop by, federal, state, local, people with complaints, people who are unhappy with your column the night before, they come to the front desk and say, "Hey, Wooster, you got somebody down here who wants to talk to you?" You get on and talk to them.
Yeah.
And it might not be a pleasant conversation, or it might be a great conversation. And when I drove by, the Journal now is in kind of a strip mall upstairs, what's left of it, in a little office. And, God bless those mostly young journalists who are just trying their best to, under-resourced and trying to do their job. But if I've been there a couple of times, the door was locked, nobody was there, there was none of that stop by and chat, or if you got a complaint about subscription or delivery or things. Dave Krantz, one time we got a call on a Saturday morning at the Argus Leader of a woman who, at the door, somebody, the paper boy, left her newspaper and stuffed it in the door, and the wind blew it open and broke the screen door window, the glass in the door. And Krantz took a newspaper over to her and swept up the glass for her helped her clean up the mess. And, that's service that doesn't exist in most places.
So what the heck happened? I mean, and the business model for sure gets a lot of talk about, but a reporter who will get in the car and go sweep up the glass and hand someone a paper, that probably isn't super common either.
Well, no, because I was dodging that call every time. I was in there on Saturday morning to get get some work done. So were the other reports. We'd be the last person to answer that phone before it was if it didn't get to circulation.
Kranz would just take it. Okay, fair enough. That's just an outlier story.
Kranz would take it. Now, if I got cornered, it depends. If I didn't, if I wasn't on too tight a deadline or stuff, right, but Kranz was always take the call. He would always do that, and there were different types of personalities in the newsroom.
Yeah.
But what happened? Oh man! I mean, it's easy to blame the corporations. The thing is, I worked for Gannett and Lee, and for a time, both of them put a lot of money into the publications at the Argus Leader in Sioux Falls and the Rapid City Journal here. They sent writing coaches in, and they sent people off to seminars, and you thought, okay, this corporation's not bad. But as things started to tighten, and they wanted to continue to give more and more to their shareholders, their stockholders, and it seemed like they were unrealistic in what they expected, they started to make, to me, really unwise decisions on what you cut and how you cut. And then the whole thing with the internet, and do we give our stuff away online for free? There's all kinds of free stuff out there. A lot of us were concerned initially when we started putting stuff up, our news, our columns up on the internet for free. And then they kind of thought that was a bad idea, and they tried to reel it back in and put stuff behind a paywall, some stuff that was premium behind a paywall, other stuff you could have, and then eventually all the stuff. And I don't know if it would have made a great deal of difference or not, because you've got this, you know, a couple generations of readers that don't believe, apparently, professionally produced news is worth paying for.
Well, I want to add something to that, and that is the public library. So now, if you want to go, you know, before, if you wanted to read the newspaper in your hometown and you didn't want to pay for it, you could go to the public library and you could read it. Now, you have to go to the public library, log on, and, you know, have a library card and enter to, you know, if they have a subscription to it and get it. That way, you might not necessarily get the print. And that is way more complicated. Now you have to sign up for a computer, and you have to know how to use the computer. Librarians are helping you do this and all that stuff. But the idea of having a local newspaper that would be left behind at a frying pan that you could flip through, the access, that's part of what gave it the idea that it was accessible. You know, somebody was getting paid for it. There was a business model, but you also had ways to access it for free.
Sure.
Quality news needs to be supported financially, but also needs to have an avenue for people who cannot afford it to read it, and that is the public library.
Yeah, and now that I mention it, I haven't looked at our library for, I don't know, it's been quite a while. They used to have a bunch of papers down there, and I would go down and read those papers so I could hold print products.
Yeah, everybody'd be down there reading those.
Everybody, including some of the people that are unhoused, would be reading newspapers. And
it's where you looked for job postings. It's where you looked for apartment rentals. All these things were free. And now, you got to have a phone. How much is that costing you? There's a new model.
And to your point, every restaurant, every hotel, either they had a stack of them on the counter at the motel or hotel that you could, if you stayed there, you could have, but then they were all just sitting around the lobby and stuff that you could read, and businesses had them out if you wanted to, if you're waiting for something or you had a doctor's appointment. The newspapers were everywhere.
Yeah.
Part of your life.
I want to also talk about what happens in those communities, and if you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment. My guest is Kevin Looster for our Dakota Political Junkies conversation today. We're talking about these four South Dakota newspapers who are closing suddenly in Huron, Redfield, Brookings, and Flandreau, the Moody County enterprise there, without warning, which also, Kevin, presents a problem for a city and county government because of legal notices in some cases.
Oh, yeah. Legal notices are an issue, and I think it was, one of the people that had been, one of the city officials had been using the daily or the more frequently, not necessarily every day, but to go to a weekly from that more frequent distribution would delay certain things, and they were concerned about that. And I think some of them maybe wouldn't even have access then to a legal newspaper in the county. I think there are I don't know. I think Dave Bordewijk had said that 40 have closed, 40 newspapers have closed roughly
since
in
the
South
90s,
Dakota.
Yeah.
There's that, the legal issue. There's, of course, the accountability issue. I spoke to a guy here who was trying to, a friend of mine who was going to try to develop a gravel pit on property he owns east of Box Elder and lost out on a 3-2 vote in the county commission. And he said there was no reporter there at the meetings and that they had a pretty good argument to sell about saving money and wouldn't have to haul gravel for some far away, and they were going to shut down if growth came near to where they were operating. But he said nobody heard that argument, and so his argument was the naysayers had all the weight because they showed up. And he said it's just another example of, he said maybe they would have made the same decision, but more people would have been involved in making it and expressing things and knowing about it.
Yeah.
And
the impact on our civic life is huge.
It is. Yeah.
So, you mentioned Dave Bordewijk and some of the Facebook comments, and I referenced in getting ready for our conversation today, of course, Public Broadcasting's reporting, but also South Dakota Searchlight's reporting on this by John Holt. And a lot of great information in one place as a nonprofit newsroom. So as these, so there's a for-profit newspaper like the Dakota Scout, there's nonprofit like South Dakota Searchlight and South Dakota Newswatch. We're still holding on by the fingernails to Public Broadcasting. What is the future? There are some community newspapers really held up by volunteerism in South Dakota, which is great, but also tenuous for a number of reasons. News is a professional. People have degrees in news often, and professional editing matters. And so I'm not sure volunteerism can be 100% where you go. Certainly there's editorial oversight. What is the future of this as we try to redefine how people get their news?
And as an aside, you mentioned professional editing.
Yeah.
One of the first things we cut at the Journal, or our publisher cut, was the copy desk.
I remember
the publisher walked in and looked around, and there were four or five copy editors sitting there. God bless those people. They took such good care of me over the years. And she said, why do we need all these copy editors? And the reporters all looked with shocked and struck with fear. I don't know about any of the rest of you, but I need them.
Yeah.
And pretty soon they were gone, and that showed up in the newspaper with
I used to read the newspaper article until I got to an error, and then I would stop reading out of frustration when that was happening. I'd be like, well, I'll read until someone makes a mistake. You didn't get very far through any of the articles because those copy editors were gone.
My colleague Bill Harlan called that performing without a net, and it was not something you particularly wanted to do. But that was one of the first things that was cut. Now, what train of thought did I take us away from that we were on?
The future. Nonprofit news, for-profit, independent startups.
When you and I were going...
Public broadcasting, or public news.
Well, first of all, I have to up my giving to public broadcasting, and I'm glad you reminded me of that. And so does all the people listening. But when we were texting back and forth yesterday a little bit, you raised an issue that I think is interesting, is... are the nonprofits, which are really good, doing nice work with actual former newspaper reporters and other types of reporters, radio reporters and things. Are they good for the papers, or are they tough on the papers? Do they give people another free option for news? That's a complicated question, because they fill in some of those gaps that I'm happy about. I'm happy that's people like Seth and all the others that are doing this work are doing it and making it available to newspapers. And I know people that read the Journal and are always quoting Searchlight or Newswatch stories that they read in the Journal.
Yeah,
they actually don't go on the website very much. They see them in the Journal. They're old traditionalists.
Yeah. It's a print product. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's great that the papers have that. If you're down to four reporters, which the Journal was not too long ago, I think, if I remember talking to them, from 13, 14, 15, or 16, you just can't cover this stuff.
Right.
And if Newswatch and Searchlight can fill in some of those gaps. It's wonderful. Right. And I never thought about it until you and I had the exchange, but does that lead some people away from subscribing to those papers?
My question is, respectfully, because I think they're doing great work, and I reference mm-hmm. them often and read them all.
As I do.
If I drive across the state of South Dakota and stop in small towns, as I often do, and pick up their local newspapers and see what's happening, I'm often reading the same story that is, and I'm not getting that local news. Where you used to be able to stop at, you know, I'm going to get some coffee at a place in Clear Lake, and then I'm going to look at the newspaper, and I'm going to get something about what's happening in that town. Not so much anymore. So some of the content is being, the column inches are being used for the same story, town to town, which is a service, but also is complicated.
Yeah. Now I would say that the readers in Chamberlain, if they use that, and the readers in, Platt, the main probably aren't the same readers, or Mobridge, or wherever they're using it, Yankton and Rapid City, certainly. Right. But
if I'm the publisher, I don't need to hide. I mean, I can cut my staff because it's all I have to do. I could become a print shop for the nonprofit newsrooms in South Dakota and fill my pages, which is not the same as local news.
I would tell you that I think they weren't getting the local news anyway, because one of the complaints I heard about the Journal was from the people that are still reading it, the Mays brothers, Terry and Larry, as you know, my buddy and your fishing guys.
They're very good day fishing.
you killed them. And they complained for a while that what they were getting was all stuff out of Montana and Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And I think probably the Wyoming and Montana people were complaining they were getting too much stuff out of South Dakota because the local paper, the local daily, wasn't able to fill their news hole all the time with local stuff. So they were picking up other stuff, AP stuff out of Nebraska or whatever. So if you can get a Newswatch story out of South Dakota, a Searchlight story out of South Dakota instead of that, I think that's a plus.
Yeah. So what else happens next? So we have the rise of nonprofit. We have some for-profit news organizations starting up and trying to expand. There's a lot of good news coverage in the state. I don't want to say that's not happening, but for these communities, for Huron, Redfield, Brookings, Moody County, what kind of models can they look at next to say, what does our community need and how can we provide it?
Well, are they going to look at one of those volunteer options where a whole bunch of people get together and take little or no pay, most of them, maybe a paid editor or something? Mm-hmm. Will they, now I understand Dakota Scout was talking about dropping papers off in Brookings and trying to reach out to that community.
I see.
You probably remember when the Journal actually, or the Argus Leader, had bureaus in Brookings and Vermilion.
Yeah.
That's kind of, I think, what they're talking about doing, 50 minutes away or whatever. I don't know. I really think, wouldn't you think, that Brookings, again, home
Brookings
of SDSU.
Brookings is a great example. SDSU is there. You cannot say that, and their radio station, I think.
They've
shut down, too.
Paper.
So, I mean, we have a boutique studio, SDPB does, in mm-hmm. Brookings, so we can connect mm-hmm. people. There's been some construction this year, so we haven't connected as much as we normally do, but we connect through with the Brookings studio often and go up there often. So, yeah, you're covering the Jackrabbits, of course. You can put a newspaper together.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
But that's easy to say, and I don't know how to do it. So that's what, but you would hope that the people in the community are going to get together, and there are going to be some potential solutions to that. That's South Dakota journalist Kevin Wooster. He was our Dakota political junkie for today. You can find this conversation and more local politics coverage on your podcast feed. Search SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies on your favorite podcast platform. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. There's a new civics guide tailor-made for the Sioux Falls community. Sioux Falls 101 from Sioux Falls Simplified covers local government basics, how to get involved, While it's written for the state's largest city, there are lessons for every citizen in the guide. Megan Raposa is the founder of Sioux Falls Simplified. She stepped into SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. Now, we've been talking about statewide politics today and statewide news on this particular show as well, as we've seen some local newspapers close. So, of course, I thought of you for a couple reasons. One is that local reporters in local towns are covering how some of these state issues unfold, such as property taxes and Mayor Paul Tangenhagen's response to them here in Sioux Falls. And also because you recently published this really great citizen guide for civic engagement. So those are the things that I'd like to talk to you about today. Give the rest of the state a little bit of an update on how some of the state initiatives like property tax relief, as it's called, are impacting cities like yours.
Yeah, it's an interesting moment for this sort of tension between state politics and local politics, especially around the property tax issue, because, you know, as folks probably know, a lot of local government is funded in a big way through property taxes. And so any changes to that revenue stream are then going to impact services in your local community. So for Sioux Falls, what that looks like is, you know, Mayor Paul Tenhaken has been pretty vocal about, you know, you're going to feel the impact of these cuts. They're looking at, you know, cutting $6 million from the budget next year, which doesn't sound like a lot in a, you know, 770 whatever million dollar budget, but it's a bigger piece of the kind of smaller chunk of that that is property tax supported funds. Right. And that does affect things like public libraries and your, you know, snow removal and trying to think of other examples of stuff, things like the Parks Department, and right. You know, he's talking about pools closing sooner and libraries not being open as many hours and those kinds of impacts, which people here will really feel, I think.
Yeah. And then there's a little back and forth between the mayor and some state legislators. But it's important to realize, too, that a lot of people, Mayor Tenhaken is saying you need to call the right person if you're upset about this. If you're upset about your library closing, you might call the mayor's office and say, why are you cutting library hours? And he might also direct you to the state government and say, this is why the libraries are closing.
Yeah.
He wanted the cuts to be noticed.
Yes, exactly. And it's very strategic. I mean, you know, I talked to him and he was like, I could have cut a couple of positions behind the scenes and nobody would really know that had happened or feel the impact of it. But by doing it in this way that's very noticeable, there is that sort of like push to say, hey, if you want this to be back the way you want it, you got to call the state. You got to call your, you know, District 12 representative or wherever you live and find, you know, call those people and say, hey, this property tax reform isn't working for us in the way that we thought. Mm. Or perhaps it is, and that is, you know, a consequence that folks are willing to accept as a result of lower property taxes.
Right. And state legislators would say, Mayor Tenhaken, you need to understand that some of these people are calling us, telling us they want property tax relief because it's too expensive in your town.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes people forget that Sioux Falls is a town.
Yeah.
With its own, you know, there's a Sioux Falls versus the rest of the state. But yet if you live here, is this a town like any others with its problems and its opportunities and its leadership and its dynamics?
Absolutely.
In that note, you put together a guide to shaping the community's future. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yes. So in the last couple of years, I've been sort of introduced to the concept of civic health. And, you know, we talk about public health a lot in terms of like obesity rates and the rates of heart disease and do people have access to fresh foods and all that kind of stuff. But civic health is looking more through the lens of, do people in the community have a seat at the table in determining the community's future? And that looks like you know, voter turnout, that looks like access to public records and public information. And, you know, local journalism plays a big, big role in that, in helping provide sort of a bridge between the government entities and the people that they're serving of here's what's going on and how you can get involved.
So this is a digital guide. You can click through, learn about a little bit about state government, really dive deep into how the city of Sioux Falls is run, including how you can show up at a city council meeting. Why was that important and how is that a measure of civic health?
I think people It can feel very intimidating. And even as a journalist, you know, I remember the first city council meeting I covered. You go into the Carnegie Town Hall. I mean, it's a big, fancy room. Mm-hmm. And there's the dais and there's the, you know, Robert's Rule of Order. And there's all these kind of it feels very intimidating in a lot of ways. So my goal was to just sort of demystify that process and break down barriers a little bit so people understand it's like, you know, this is your space too. And if you have an issue that you're concerned about, you absolutely can take your, you know, 3 to 5 minutes, whatever, you know, mm-hmm. in front of the city council and say, I feel this way about this, or this impacts me in my neighborhood, or whatever it might be. And you've got a voice that way.
And they might not, you point out in your guide, which I thought was really important, they might not respond back to you during that public comment if it wasn't on the agenda.
Yes.
Which can feel a little awkward. So you also tell people, like, hey, this is what's going to happen when you go do that. You might be met with silence.
Yeah.
But that's part of the process.
Yes. And it is, it's, you know, the sort of Midwesterners, you know, it's like, hey, you want somebody to respond to you. You want them to like make eye contact and nod along so that, you know, they're listening, and you just, you won't experience that. And that's okay. They are listening.
Right.
And there are ways to connect offline as well. And, right. and kind of outside of the meeting to get more, you know, one-on-one feedback with counselors. But that really is a good platform to get your positions out there.
In that meeting, you're putting something into the public record that is a large part of what you're doing at that point. How has some of the response been throughout the guide? It's a digital guide, so you click through it. You say, hey, there are the questions that you want to know. Are people responding and saying, hey, I've always wanted to know about this, that?
It's been very well received. I've gotten some great feedback on it, which is awesome. I got to give credit to Michaela Voris, who's a summer fellow with Sioux Falls Simplified through the Reynolds Journalism Institute. And she did a tremendous amount of work pulling this together. And one of the things that I think we've received probably the most positive feedback on is just having this kind of one-stop shop to understand a bunch of stuff. One thing we're expanding is adding more sort of topic-based explainers. So we've got one up right now on the city budget process and how that works. Because it's, you know, it's a big old document with a lot going on and a lot of departments represented. So more of that kind of stuff is still in the works as well.
Do you think something like this can help create a different future in a city? Do you think, I mean, and how would you measure it? Are you measuring it as a journalist? You're measuring, well, how many people opened this? How many people subscribed to Sioux Falls Simplified? That's great. I'm giving a service that people like. But if people show up and testify at a city or make comments at the city council meeting and they're different people who haven't mm-hmm. been there before, is that something that you're looking for?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, I really want to see more engagement, especially in, we have an election year coming up next year, and the mayoral race is going to be a big one. It's a huge job, and the amount that the city has grown and changed in complexity over the course of Mayor Paul Tenhaken's term, I mean, this is not your average mayoral position. Like, this has become a pretty big deal. So I think what success looks like for me with this guide is if people feel comfortable reaching out to me and saying, I would like to hear from the mayoral candidates about XYZ. I would like to hear, you know, maybe we're hosting forums about it. Maybe we're hosting, you know, some kind of events around it. But just that kind of participation and give and take. And, you know, I can't really draw a straight line between voter turnout and my own coverage.
Sure.
But I would love to live in a community where more than, you know, 8% of people show up for a city election.
That's Megan Raposa from Sioux Falls Simplified. Learn more about their Sioux Falls 101 guide at their website, sfsimplified.com. Or you can head to our website for a link, sdpb.org/news. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you in the moment. It's produced by R. Youngman and Ellen Kester. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, thanks for listening.